Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Como mamá, siempre quiero lo mejor para mi familia. Por eso quiero lo mejor en mi cocina. Y eso significa solo huevos Eggland's Best. No importa cómo los cocines, siempre saben frescos y deliciosos. Y tienen más vitaminas D y E y el doble de omega 3 que los huevos regulares. Entonces, ¿por qué conformarte con menos cuando puedes tener lo mejor? Eggland's Best. Mejor sabor, mejor nutrición, mejores huevos.
This Week in Retronauts, Be Kind, Rewind. Welcome to this episode of Retronauts, whichever episode of Retronauts this may happen to be. I'm Jeremy Parrish. That, at least, is a constant. And so, too, is the constant to my right.
Hey, it's Bob Mackie, and I rewind all of my tapes in a thing shaped like a Corvette.
Yes, that, as you should.
A red Corvette.
Oh, wow. Yeah. A little red Corvette?
It's actually very little.
you're the prince of videotapes.
Was Prince singing about a VHS tape rewinder? Oh, my God.
Was,
yeah. He was ahead of his time.
Right. He was way on top of things. He was a visionary.
Man.
It's really sad that we missed him. And in addition to the constant, we have the variable.
James Eldred in this podcast requires a $100 deposit.
Wow.
Wow.
Back in the old days.
Yeah.
All right. So yes, it's true. There's no escaping it. We're talking about video stores. And we've been making VHS references because that kind of is how old we are. But in truth, we're going to be talking about video stores vis-a-vis their relationship to video games. And this was a request by James, who is kind enough to help host us, Bob and I, while we are here in sunny Tokyo, Japan.
Sunny, too hot Tokyo, Japan.
Yes, actually, It's very hazy right now.
Yeah.
I've been enjoying it.
Yes. Well, someone does.
James is putting me up, and I've been a perfect gentleman the entire time.
I'm glad you haven't taken advantage of him.
I've only taken advantage of his nice shower.
We just don't take
that. That sounds really weird.
Oh, wait, no. scratch that. He has a very nice shower, is what I'm saying.
I'm glad to hear that.
Please don't take advantage. So, my boyfriend will be very mad.
Anyway, this is already going in weird places, but... Yes. James, actually, why don't you tell us why you wanted to talk about this particular topic?
Well, video stores are kind of important for me. My family has been in the video business pretty much since 1983. My father opened a video store in my hometown of Toledo, Ohio, back in 1983, Sights and Sounds Home Video. And we had that from 1983 until 1997 when we sold out to the man, to Blockbuster, and got out.
And how did that go for Blockbuster?
It went really bad because it turns out Blockbuster was not a good business.
Yeah.
And they did everything wrong.
They did. I did I did rent from them for a while.
I didn't rent. I mean, growing up, I never had to. I rented from Blockbuster maybe three or four times in my entire life.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever rented from Blockbuster.
No, I think
our family took it as a point of pride that we only supported the local video stores. Also, Blockbuster was a drive, so...
Yeah, well, my main memories of renting from Blockbuster were in late 1993. They sent out this like coupon or something for rent for one day and get 4 days free or something. So I completed Secret of Mana for like $3. That was a lot cheaper than buying it for $60. So That's about my Blockbuster memory.
It's a good plan.
Once upon a time, video stores were really a part of the video game experience. Sometime in the mid to late 80s, you know, once Nintendo's entertainment system really kind of took off, you know, video stores realized, hey, this is adjacent to what we rent. We should also rent these things.
Yeah, it took us a while. Like I said, we opened in 83, and of course, we weren't renting Atari games or anything. But once other stores in Toledo started renting video games, my dad jumped on that pretty hard after I went to a competitor to rent Arkanoid, and a customer saw me. We ended up starting carrying it. Yeah.
Were you the secret shoppers got you?
Yeah, it was bad. But I still remember that day we went to Toys R Us and we bought what I felt like was 1,000 games, and I got to test them out, in quotes, before we put them on the shelves, and that was like 9-year-old me was beyond stoked.
When you walked home from that competing video store, did your dad say, "I can smell Arkanoid on you"? You bring that into my home.
He was actually mad.
Oh wow!
Not at me.
Sorry to bring up
the no. At the situation.
Okay.
I learned it from you, Dad.
Yeah. So yeah, the that was in Toledo, but those there were only really two big stores. There was Video Connection and us. So yeah, he was mad.
I don't actually know what I'm going to say in this episode. I feel like James has a pretty good idea of what he wants to say, but yeah. I felt like this was a topic that was worth incorporating at least into a Retronauts micro, just because it is part of sort of, I guess, you know, vanishing Americana, like the former experience of playing video games, something that people these days do not understand. I mean, there are still rentals, but it's like Redbox, and it's not the same as video stores back in the day.
And the video stores that still exist, they're most of them, other than Family Video, which is still kicking it.
Really?
The independent chains, and they do not focus on games anymore. I don't know the reasons why. Maybe that's just not economically feasible. The people who go to a video store in 2018 are not looking to rent a new game.
Yeah, and I think just the way games drop in price so quickly now, like all physical media, if you want a game for cheap, wait 3 months or wait for the Steam sale. Even like God of War, which just came out as of this recording, will be like $30 at Christmas.
Yeah. There's just no point in people, you know, online stuff. And it just, I think people, the relationship with games, nobody wants to keep a game for a weekend anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of other factors like, you know, to combat rentals, publishers really pushed hard like 10 years ago to start incorporating, and also to prevent resales, started incorporating things like one-time download codes. And, you know, what was it, that game that was like set in World War II, The Saboteur, was that it? If you bought it in advance, so like pre-ordered it or bought it at retail or whatever, you could get a code to like have the women topless in the cabarets or something.
I think there might have been vintage Playboys in that game, or maybe that's Mafia, something like that. I don't know.
But, yeah, I think that was Mafia. Yeah.
Well, there was no other place to see breasts, so they had the market corner.
The internet didn't exist.
No.
Yeah, but like, I don't know if you want to get in any history of it now, but like, video game developers and publishers' consensus relationship with video stores is not a new thing. That goes back to Nintendo.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's true, yeah. I mean, whenever I do research for old games, which is a lot, it's always fun and also infuriating to see what, in a very specific couple of years, maybe there's like a 3-year span in which a lot of things were changed in American versions of those games just for the American market to combat people finishing it in a weekend. And it's just like, I want the version of the game that doesn't crush you.
Right. Yeah, it was this like sudden light switch that flipped. Like you can kind of tell about when rental stores became a thing in America, because that is the point at which American versions of games went from being like really easy to really hard. Like they tended to neuter games. Like look at Mega Man 8 or Mega Man 2, where the Japanese version has one difficulty mode and the American version has two difficulty modes, normal and hard. Hard is actually the default Japanese version, like the only version that was in the Japanese game. And then easy mode is like half damage values for everything. So, you know, you go from that to maybe 2 years later or 3 years later, Ninja Gaiden 3 and Castlevania 3, where they tweak damage values. In Ninja Gaiden 3, they took away infinite continues. So you have to beat this crushingly hard game in five continues. That's unreasonable and not fun.
I'm thinking of basically every Konami game released in 1990, 1991, like Castlevania 3, Roller Games, Mission Impossible, Tiny Toon Adventures. They all feel like they are designed to, you need to sit with them for more than a weekend. They're just like very adversarial in terms of their design.
Yeah, well, it's not only the games, it's the legalities around the games, because we're talking about the American versions, because in Japan, you can't rent video games.
Yeah,
right?
Still.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In Japan and in America, the 8-bit rental market, it's kind of like A-B testing, where like what happens with one outcome, what happens with the other. In the U.S., basically the courts, I think, upheld the right to rent video games under the same, basically the same rules that allowed home taping and things like that.
It was even more than that. So what happened was, first in Japan, first anything went, and people were renting games, and they were even renting cracking software, like in the early days before Nintendo. And then the laws changed, you know, and in Japan you can't rent games, but you can rent music. But there's
that's the crazy thing.
Like, yeah,
you and can rent music in for a long time. I'm sorry.
There's a window, like. For most stuff, I think it's a week, sometimes a month, where you can't rent it, and then eventually you can rent the record at the video store. It's kind of like the music equivalent of having something in the theaters and then something in the video store. And with games in America, like that never happened. You know, it was always the same with videos. But Nintendo, it wasn't just a matter of making the games harder or getting angry. They went to Congress. They lobbied to make renting games illegal. And eventually, I forgot the name of the act. There's a great video about it by a video game historian on YouTube talking about it. And he basically explains that there is an exception. So renting computer software is illegal in America, but renting video games isn't. And the distinction is basically a dedicated console. You have to hook up. It makes a definition for video game consoles, you know, because at the time they were like, you can't pirate these.
Yeah.
Because at the time you couldn't.
I mean, video game rentals are the byproduct of a new technology, VHS. There would not be video game rentals if not for VHS. And with any new technology, there's like a fear that it will destroy the world. And with VHS, I think it was Jack Valenti of the MPAA crafting doomsday scenarios as if what would happen if people could tape programs off the TV.
Yeah.
It would destroy the movies forever. So, yeah.
And the thing with videos was like VCRs came about in the early 70s to mid 70s, but they didn't really take off until home video. And one company named Magnetic Video Corporation leased the rights to 50 videos from 20th Century Fox. And those were the very first VHS tapes. And that was in 1977. And at the time, most studios were terrified of it until they realized this is a really good secondary market.
Yeah.
And by the late 80s, home video was making more money than the theater.
Until the prospect of huge profits comes along, it is a doomsday scenario. They're like, oh, we can make money. Well, who cares what happens? Yeah. We're making money.
Yeah, we're making money. Yep. And they made a ton of money because videotapes cost $120 all the way up until DVD. And yeah.
We should talk about that. That's really interesting.
I mean, that's true for the ones that were sold to rental markets. But, you know, you go to Best Buy or Walmart and you were buying cassette tapes, VHS tapes for like $20.
But not right away. Usually.
No, not right away. Yeah. But by the time I was able to buy my own videos, they were late 80s, early 90s. They had come down in price.
No, most of them were still $120. And then 6 to 12 months later, they were go down in price. There was the rental price and then sell through. And we would have.
It's true, Jerry.
Because there were almost everything. Big, some huge titles would go straight to sell through, and it would be a big deal. We'd get a sales packet that would say Jurassic Park is straight to sell through, and that's the coding they used, and it would be $14.99, $19.99. But 90% of stuff when it came out was $79.99 to $120, because my dad's secondary business was selling used videos to libraries, and we were selling them between $39.99 and $49.99 and $59.99 30 days after they came out.
Yeah, so like if you went to the video store to rent Back to the Future when it came out on VHS, you could not also go to a store and buy Back to the Future off the shelf.
Yeah, very rare. Not right away. Eventually, yeah. Yes. Most
but
things.
But not immediately yeah. upon the rental. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that really changed by the early 90s.
It did.
I mean, it became more common, but it really didn't change until right before DVD. Yeah, so 95. Because Warner Brothers decided they were done with videos. They wanted to change their business model. And that's when stuff started costing $40 and $30, kind of getting ready for DVD. Sorry.
I remember buying, you know, stuff that was coming out at Best Buy or whatever, like brand new, and it would be on sale for $15, $25.
But that was probably like 20 years after the medium had existed, right?
Yeah, I'm talking like early 90s, but that's what I was saying. It was like early 90s that had changed a lot. But I do remember, you know, like seeing MSRP on tapes that were like $100, and I would be like, but that's unrealistic. What? That's crazy. I would never pay that much.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea was that it would go to rental shops. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, the only time I ever remember anyone wanting to spend that much money for a movie day and date, the day it came out, was Ghost.
Mm.
We had customers asking to buy Ghosts. I remember this.
Why? Why Ghost?
I don't know. Also,
the market was really different back then, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
Ghost was huge.
Ghost was a huge goddamn movie.
What your mom got hot over.
Yeah. And it was one of the movies also that had the tape was a special color to stop bootlegging. To stop piracy.
You're right. It had like a blue.
It was white.
Oh, white. Okay. Yeah.
E.T. was
Ghost white.
E.T. I think had either part of it was green or it was all green. A few movies would do that to stop to kind of you could easily find counterfeits.
Yeah, with E.T., we were just talking about this earlier a couple days ago, where there was there'd be a huge gulf in between the film release and the VHS release. I remember as a little kid in 1988 or so, we got a copy of E.T. because it had never been on VHS ever. Period. Mm-hmm. And that is just like 6 years after the movie was released.
That was an exceptional case, but yeah, the window between the theater and home video used to be much larger.
Even with big movies like Jurassic Park, it was fall of the next year.
Usually, yeah.
It was crazy mm-hmm. back then.
But like I said, they realized really quickly they could make a lot of money that way, and there were even movies like by the early 80s, there were movies that were making the money back on video. Like my dad always cites Scarface. Scarface bombed when it came out in the theaters, but he made a ton of money off of it, and because people would keep renting it, and other stuff like that. Like usually genre movies, B movies would make a ton of money on video. Faces of Death,
yeah,
you know, we always the statistic we always had was our biggest per capita titles were Faces of Death and any Cheech and Chong movie.
And then there were companies like Troma that would just focus on the VHS market,
and
bypass theaters altogether.
The as VHS became bigger, the grindhouse died.
Yeah,
and those B movie studios moved their way over to VHS tape,
and like Full Moon Pictures too.
Yeah, the Puppet Master movies.
Yeah, they've got a lot like of that. The IP.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, the big renters too. Yeah, the genre stuff was usually the biggest stuff. And actually.
Earlier about how you can rent music in Japan. Mm-hmm. That's something that's always fascinated me, is just like CD rental cafes. And, you know, that was why Minidisc was so big over here, was because it was like a CD quality recordable medium. So people would rent CDs and just record them. But we didn't really have that in the US because you couldn't rent CDs.
Yeah.
No one, I don't know of anyone who rented CDs.
Well, you couldn't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was illegal.
So yeah, that's fascinating. Like, how come video games were allowed to be rented in the U.S., but not CDs and vice versa in Japan?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there was legislation to stop it. There was legislation in the very early rental times to stop music rentals, and that succeeded. But the legislation to stop PC rentals because of piracy went through, and then they put in the exception for home media. And I think Blockbuster must have had a better lobbying group than Nintendo.
Loophole for libraries because they don't charge anything.
Yeah, libraries can rent music.
Yeah.
Libraries can rent damn near anything.
Well, they don't rent, they lend.
They lend.
So I think that's the difference.
Yeah, but they can rent music and even games. Like you see libraries renting games now, which is hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I know of people, like I'm connected to people through social media, or whatever, who that's how they play most of their games. Like they acquire the software or the hardware they need, but they can't really afford software, so they acquire from libraries. And you know, it's great that libraries still exist and that they're keeping up with contemporary media.
Yeah, your taxes paid for those games. You might as well play them.
Your taxes paid for this library to buy 120 copies of American Pie 3.
I mean, that still sounds better than bombing Afghanistan.
True.
With our tax money.
Yeah.
So, I'm all for it. Like, Congress, keep buying American Pie 3. God bless you.
But one interesting thing about the legislation was Nintendo tried to stop. It was just Nintendo. Sega was all about rental. Nintendo tried to stop it. When they couldn't do that, they sued over Blockbuster copying the manuals.
Yeah. Oh man, I love, and I hope there are scans of those online. Just the handmade manuals made by, like, I don't know, third parties.
Well, there was a company that would, I can't remember what it was called.
Video Dude or something?
There were a few of them.
Yeah.
But they would create these, you know, custom cards that didn't use any copyrighted art, but that basically reproduced the contents of the manual in a slightly paraphrased way.
It was just like one, like a sticker basically on the inside of the case.
Yeah, there would be like you'd get like the plastic case the game would come in, and we would glue in that little cheap fake manual, because we stopped copying manuals not because of any legal thing, but because it was a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You'd have to dismantle the manual.
Yeah, I scan manuals and it's a pain in the ass. So.
Well, this is not scan. This is feeding it into a copy.
Right. Like, that's enough of a pain in the ass, like having to do it and then assemble it and so forth. Like, no thanks.
And it was always a real problem when there was the occasional game that you needed something in the manual. Mm. The first example I could think of was Star Tropics.
Yep.
Well, that's Nintendo flipping off the rental market.
Yeah, and so we would have to include a thing like, if you get to this point, you do this.
Mm.
Yeah. Stuff like that. Yeah.
So what experiences did you guys have with rentals? Obviously, James, you had sort of the insider perspective.
Yeah.
But what about you, Bob? Like, when did you first start renting games?
I think the main appeal was as part of a family with not a lot of money, it was a great way to actually have entertainment in your life. So renting, going to the rental store or the video store every Friday was sort of a thing in my family, and like getting pizza and stuff, and all of us retreating to our separate rooms and watching our stuff. But probably the time I got my NES, from that point on, that's when I started renting games. And I never really owned a lot of games for the NES, just because I rented everything. I would go to the video store every weekend. So I'd get a game for Christmas and a game for my birthday, but I probably only owned like 8 games for the NES, just because we had so many local rental stores.
Yeah. That checks out with like my personal experiences and with my friends coming to the store. You know, like, renting was such a big part of the NES culture, I think, because there were so many games.
Yeah.
And back then it was, you know, your only way to find out if a game was good was to read reviews and or just play it yourself. So you're not going to, you can't go on, there's no Let's Play, there's no video of it. So that's a good way to find out if the game was good. A lot of time before you buy. Rental was really good for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I had never considered renting video games, but a friend of mine took me to a video store with him. I like went over to stay the night at his place one weekend, and we were just going to play video games. And he was like, "Let's go to the video store." And I was like, "What?" So we went, and he rented some games, and I was like, "You can do this? That's really cool." And it was actually really handy for me, because I owned my NES for a couple of years before I started renting. And in those first couple of years, a lot of friends of mine had video games, and we would basically just trade back and forth. And that was how we all kind of, you know, circulated games and tried different things. We'd all buy different games and swap them back and forth. But after a while, most of them kind of lost interest. So the pool of available games to borrow and trade kind of dried up. So right around the time that happened, you started seeing rentals. And so that became a great way for me to continue to expand my horizons. And there was a video shop called Hastings, which was I guess it's still a chain in Texas and Oklahoma. And they do books, videos, and music and video games, sales and rentals. It was like a bookstore that also rented stuff. So it was, I could just go there for like an hour and wander around looking at books and checking out magazines. And then you know, figuring out something to rent.
Yeah.
And, it was within biking distance. So in the summer, I would just bike over there and I'd find video games to rent. Sometimes they'd send out coupons like, you know, free rental or something like that. So that was a cheap way for me for a couple of summers to get a lot of entertainment and stay occupied. And, you know, occasionally games would come in and I'd be like, I want to rent this, but I can't get it right now. So I would hide the tag behind other stuff that no one wanted. And then I'd come back a few days later and pick it up. I'd rent it. Don't shake your head like that. It would get used. What's that?
We knew.
We checked.
You checked?
We at the store, we would. Well, and at our store. Now, I know I was a kid for most of this, but I worked. I was a teenager by the time the store closed, and my early teens was spent working at the video store. And one of the things, since I was the gamer, I would go through, and at our store, we didn't have tags. The games were on the shelf.
Mm.
And it was one of my jobs on organizing the sales was to make sure the games were not hidden.
Oh, no, they didn't do that at ours. Yeah. No one cared that much. The video games were off in kind of a corner, and they would have the boxes out, like the actual NES boxes in a plastic shell, and then there would be a tag that they would slide into. It was like a plastic strip with the name of the game on a label on top. And you would take that up to the front and they would give you the game. So I would just like put the tag for the game I wanted in the back of a game that no one was going to touch. So it'd stay there for a few days. I could come back, you know, right before the weekend and grab it or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was a little dishonest maybe, but it was fine. No one else really wanted to rent Battle of Olympus, but just in case, I was going to keep it for myself.
You hide Battle Olympus behind anticipation.
Yeah, something like that. Pretty much.
Those people on the cover are having so much fun. I want to be part
of
that.
They had all the fun. They used it up.
Damn.
The video game section was actually right next to the porn section.
Oh, yeah.
And
was there a beaded curtain?
No. There Weird. Was just like the adult really? Video. There was like, this was West Texas, very prude, very Bible Belt. And the video section, like the porn section was right there. It was like the game section or game aisle one, game aisle two, porn section. And right in the middle, joining the two, was the Panesian trilogy for NES. So they actually had Bubble Bath Babes and those the other two games by Panesian. Like you could rent those and they were actually like shelved with the porn, but it was like right next to the video game. So it was like, you know, the marriage of the two.
That's sort of the airlock before you get into the porn
section.
Pretty
much, yeah. And I was really fascinated by that. I was like, there's dirty video games? That's so weird. Like I never rented them. I never felt the desire to rent them. But now I wish I had actually rented them and lost them because they're really valuable.
Yeah, we had a few locations and at the main store. Even as a kid, I was kind of I helped my dad choose the games because he knew I knew what I was talking about. At the other stores, other people did it. And I vividly remember one time going into the store and there were these games for adults only. And were the other three of those games?
Yes, there's Bubble Bath Babes, Hot Slots, and Peekaboo Poker.
I remember Bubble Bath Babes the most. And we had stickers on them. You couldn't be, you know, adults only. And I remember thinking, I'm like, probably 10 or 11 years old. I'm like, that's not legal. Like that's a fake game. And, but the owner that didn't care. And I don't think they really rented because those people just got porn.
Yeah. I don't know that I ever saw the tags for those games out. Not that I like spent that much time looking at them, but I would, you know, check on them just because I was like, these are so weird.
Yeah. They're very valuable now, right?
Yeah, they are actually more valuable than their Japanese counterparts. And there were actually several more of those games published over here. They all had names AV something, adult video. So
yeah. I'm waiting for the Crontendo on those.
Oh, jeez.
The whole experience.
I'm surprised that it hasn't covered those.
He's in 90 now?
I guess, does he do the unlicensed games? Maybe not.
I'm not sure.
Because those were all by a company called... it was published by Panesian in the US, but it was Sachin in Japan, I think, which is like a Taiwanese company, if I'm not mistaken. But there were a lot more of the sort of smutty, unlicensed Nintendo NES Famicom games in Japan than there were in the US. Those kind of stand out because there were just three of them in the US, and they had them at my very, you know, the rental store in my very prude local city.
It was renting for video stores. was true of our store, and I'm so sure it was true for most independent stores. Like, if you bought movies, when you bought movies, you bought them from a distributor. There were companies that existed to sell to retail outlets. Those companies didn't do business with video stores for the most part. So you would just get them from wherever. We would go to Toys R Us or other places, and that's how you'd end up with games like that also. People who would, some mail order catalog, you'd buy them.
Buy everything.
And so looking back at the video store, it's interesting to think about what games we had that are now really valuable. Like those, or just kind of strains, like what, Color Dreams.
Some of those are worth a lot.
We had Chiller.
Did you get it? I don't know if that one's worth a lot. Yeah.
The
Bible stuff, actually.
We had those too.
Yeah, like Sunday Funday is worth a lot. And also stuff like Zombie Nation.
Yeah.
Like those games are super. Kitchen Panic or Panic Restaurant, that's it.
I would imagine at the main location, at one point, we probably had almost every game because it was a huge store. It was bigger than most Blockbusters.
I imagine no video store at Action 52, though, just because you had to... Yeah. Oh, did you?
I never saw that.
Okay, yeah.
I never saw that.
Because you had to order from that company and spend $200 or however much it was.
It was, I think, $199.
Yeah? What garbage.
No, I never saw that. But I remember, like, when I look at, like, the stuff that's rare now, I'm just kind of like, I had that at my house for, like, we had it at the store. And when we sold the store, I could have grabbed them, but I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much me going to a retro gaming shop here in Japan. I'm like, oh, I used to own that. Oh, it's like $600 now. I really should.
I think with kind of related to that is with renting games more than movies, theft was always a bigger issue. And I would imagine, especially those limited ones, like even back then, there were rental only games. They weren't always good. There was the Clay Fighter one.
Oh, yeah.
But there was that Madden one.
Yeah, and there was Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine. There was, that was N64.
Okay. Yeah.
There was,
I thought there was a Dr. Mario Tetris game that was Blockbuster only.
Could be. There were several Blockbuster. There was a Razor Scooter game for N64 that was Blockbuster only.
Yeah. But those were pretty easy to get if you were another Fight video Guy. Store.
Final Fight Guy, I bet, was a very popular thing to steal.
Yeah, Final Fight Guy. Yeah. And there was the Madden one that was just all Madden teams.
Mm.
The Championship Edition Madden. And for Genesis only, I think. Might have been Super Nintendo.
I never heard of that one. No, yeah. It was just Genesis because I never heard of that
and,
one.
And that was one that, you know, we would occasionally put stickers on there, like, you know, so people wouldn't do what you talked about in the Tetris episode of losing the copy.
Is that known as shrinkage?
That's known as fraud.
That's a felony.
It is a crime.
Yeah.
And so, like, people, this would happen with movies and games. People would say, like, oh, we lost the game. Oh, well, that's $100. Like, oh, we found it.
Here it is.
Dude, we lost that copy of Little Mermaid. Oh, that's out of print. So, you know, find it.
Look at your contract you signed with us.
Yeah. Don't leave it in your car because it'll melt. You know, if you lose it, find it. Yeah.
Speaking of exclusives, it was funny how Nintendo fought the rental market, but in the late 90s, they were best buds with Blockbuster in terms of like, come and get your Pokemon Snap pictures printed out here. So I guess they found value in that at some point.
Yeah. And we watched, I showed Bob this video, and maybe you watched it, of a Video Software Deals Association convention.
Terrible cinematography.
Yeah.
Especially when they were filming women.
Yeah. But that was the big... That's like E3 for video stores. And it was
That's the one with you in it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Wait, I was looking online.
I didn't
online.
See that.
I was looking online for this video because I knew I was at one of them. And I found one from 96. And I'm like, I think I was at that one. I wonder if 10 seconds in the video you can see me because I'm a giant 6.5 foot tall man pushing my aunt in a wheelchair who came with me. So we kind of stood out. But that was when they were whining and dining video stores. So you'd have like B-level celebrities there, like Pat Boone, Barbara Eden,
Joan Rivers was there.
Yeah. Gates McFadden, and who played Counselor Troy?
Marina Sirtis.
I knew you would know, so thank you. They were there. But some A-level people, too. We got Robert Rodriguez's autograph that year. He was there. The director of Desperado and, you know, from Dusk Till Dawn, stuff like that. But video games were a big presence there, too. And we watched that one from, I think, 94 that had this huge booth for Nintendo, and they had a fake Stunt Race FX car.
Yeah.
And
actually, Charles Martinet.
Yeah.
Martinet. You could see him in that video as a floating Donkey Kong head, sounding very much like Mario and harassing every woman
it's
that walked
me,
by.
Donkey
He's like,
Kong.
How about I give you a kiss?
Yeah. What are you doing later? Bananas.
Banana pasta.
He really just has one shtick when it comes to audience interaction, Charles Martinet. Martinet.
Martinet is something
Martinet.
Else.
It's Martinet.
It is not. It is, oh. A Martinet is, you don't want to be called a Martinet.
Hmm.
Okay, well, this is not a hill I want to die on, so I don't know.
But it's fun to see him as Donkey Kong,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But I was surprised when I told my father I was doing this. He sent me over financials for the last year of the video store. He happened to just have that for some reason. And I was surprised how small video games were compared to the rest of the store. Like, you know, if I look at that, like...
Wasn't Super NES like... 15% or something?
Yeah, so let me look it up now. It's not in any order. I don't know why. So the biggest part was action, and action movies were a third of our business.
Hmm.
And then we get to, like, Nintendo was... This is December 1996. At that point, the regular Nintendo was less than 1%. But the Super Nintendo was only 5%. Like, it says here 5%.
Oh, I thought it was more. Okay, I misremembered the numbers.
And, well, let me see that. Rents.
But yeah. It was all made up for by Virtual Boy, right?
Yeah, so my dad's store was unique, mostly because I would pressure him into buying systems I wanted to play but not buy. So we had a 3DO, a Jaguar, and a Virtual Boy you could rent, and the games. And in December of 1996, we had Chen 3DO rentals somehow. Where's Jaguar? I'm getting to the Virtual Boy. Jaguar, we had 5 Jaguar rentals, some 8 titles, and we had 6 Virtual Boy titles and 1 rental. We made $2.99 on the Virtual Boy that month.
You tanked that business.
Mm-hmm. What was the Virtual Boy game that someone wanted to play? Which one was it? Nestor's Funky Bowling?
I hope so. I don't.
Telleroboxing.
I'm more curious about what 5 Jaguar games people rented, because other than Tempest and Aliens vs. Predator, they're all, that's it.
Bubsy?
It was Trevor McFur.
Yeah. But yeah,
Pick Your Poison.
Yeah, people always talk about, you know, adult video being a big market. And it was, but like, it was only 5% of our business at that point. And I talked to my dad, late fees were 10 to 20%.
Oh.
So I thought it would be more. But yeah.
Could the relative, I guess, video game rentals were like minority of profits.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Could that be because for big releases, even small video stores would get like 6 to 8 copies of a new big movie?
But, well, for big releases, we would get 20 to 30 to 40.
Yeah, I remember when, the heyday of video stores, when you'd go after right at a big release for something like Indiana Jones or something, it would just be like an entire wall of one
movie. We prided ourselves on having the most of a new release and also the back catalog. I don't want to... The one thing my dad really wanted me to mention when I told him I was doing this is that from the second Blockbuster opened to the second we sold the store to them, we kicked their ass. Especially with new releases, everything. And so we would get a ton of new releases, and they would... Those were actually usually lost leaders, though. We wouldn't make money on a new release until they sold it.
Mm. Would it get people in the store, though?
It would get people in the store, and they couldn't get Jurassic Park because it was gone. So let's get something else.
Right. And they'd buy some popcorn.
And they'd buy some popcorn, or they would wait in the video store for 3 goddamn hours for a copy to come in, which would sometimes happen. But with video games, they were less of the business, but we made more money off of them because they would have longer shelf life, and they were cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you made like 10 to 20% of your money from late fees.
Yeah.
Was there like a cleaning fee for the porn videos?
Oh.
like wave a black light wand over it and be
I
like,
I have a
okay.
story I'm not telling on this podcast.
Oh my I apologize for bringing it up. It was just meant to be a harmless joke.
Yeah.
The logistics of that, Jeremy, I don't quite understand.
Yeah. But one thing I forgot to mention here was this is 1990. This is December of 95. So the PlayStation came out in September. So in December of 95, we had only, we had 30 titles, 30 PlayStation titles, but over 200 rentals.
Mm.
So that's a hell of a return on investment for the time.
So it's like six rentals per unit.
People have written Destruction Derby like bonkers.
So when you say titles, does that mean different titles, multiple units potentially, or like... 30 or whatever
I would imagine
games.
It might be individuals. It might be like this 30 might be three copies of one game. But for most games, the most we got were two or three.
Mm, yeah.
It had to be a pretty big title for us to get more than two. So especially for PlayStation's an unproven market at the time.
Right.
So we're not and harder to find. So we weren't going to go crazy on that. Yeah.
Stores was, as you mentioned, the turnaround on they would buy stuff and then sell it like a month later after their initial profits had been made, or the hype had died down. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of video games at very good prices very, very soon after release that way. I remember buying UN Squadron, Castlevania 3, Lolo 2 or 3, a bunch of other stuff. Like, you know, a month after it came out, they would put the surplus copies out for sale for less than half price. It was amazing.
Yeah, video games, used video games, we didn't sell them. We actually didn't sell them very often, but when we did, they always move immediately.
Hmm.
Used videos would sometimes be in our store for sale forever. If you wanted a copy of Chud on VHS tape, which is a great film, you know, we would get rid of that and put it in the for sale bin, $9. He'd be there forever. I remember when we were the last month of the store in our used area, there were big box titles. A big box title is the early days of video, the boxes were huge.
Mm-hmm.
And
kind of like with CDs.
Yeah.
Everything was just too big.
Yeah. And porn kept that that box size. But
it's like a shoebox.
Yeah, regular VHS got more form factor. So you would see, I remember City of the Living Dead, The Deadly Spawn. All these super early VHS tapes, we had them forever because nobody wanted to buy those. And I had no idea why.
Oh, I was just going to ask why not, but I guess
because
you don't know.
I didn't have enough money yet.
Mm.
And it's funny, a lot of those titles later on became really collectible on DVD because those were really rare movies. So, like, for some reason, like that market didn't exist yet, maybe.
And your family got out of the video business before DVD.
Yeah, it's really funny. We sold the store in April of 96. I think DVDs existed in Japan, but not in America yet. I don't know if my dad had an idea that the tide was, shifting or the moods were changing, but he got out at the perfect time.
Oh, yeah.
He got out at the peak. He went out on top. And Blockbuster bought that store. Like I said, I heard stories from my friends who stayed there to work there of customers coming in and tearing up the membership card and not coming back. They had brand loyalty and stuff like that. And, that Blockbuster ended up staying open until all the Blockbusters closed. So I guess Toledo has a good rental market.
And there's maybe, I think there's like one remaining Blockbuster or two.
There are four as of right now, yeah. May 2018, there are four Blockbusters and they are all in Canada. Not in Canada, Alaska.
Alaska, there you go.
Yeah. The biggest chain in America now is Family Video.
Right.
Because they are, the thing about Blockbuster was, it's like people like to blame Netflix for killing Blockbuster. And it totally helped. And it's like with Tower Records. Like MP3s didn't kill Tower Records. Debt killed Tower Records. Blockbuster expanded so fast, they took on all this debt, and they didn't own any real estate. They would always rent. So like when they bought my dad's business, they didn't buy the building. So they were paying us rent forever, which was great. And so they couldn't liquidate that much. Family Video owns most of their locations, so they're not paying rent. You know, and they keep they're big in the Midwest still. Last time I was in Toledo, it was a busy store, and they have like 3 locations in Toledo, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, there's still one right by my house in Youngstown.
Yeah,
so Midwest.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing to do in Ohio. So yeah,
head to Family Video. Yeah. I mean, there's opioids and Family Video.
Yeah,
so,
you know, you get both together. Well, you know, the biggest
what a night.
The biggest renters. Like I said, the biggest renters were Faces of Death and Cheech and Chong.
True.
Who's renting those? Stoners.
I do want to talk about though how you could rent things in more than just rental stores, because I remember it was good as a kid because in certain stores in the Midwest, like Giant Eagle is a Midwestern grocery store chain, and Farmore was a Midwestern sort of like Walmart-y type store. There would be an entire section of the building which is like, here's our video store. There's like a different entrance you go in into, and like I just would go in there. My mom would shop, and she'd come get me, and I'd have a game. So
yeah, in Texas we had Albertsons and United Supermarket, and all of those stores in the late 80s, early 90s had big video sections. And you know, when I was looking for NES games that had gone out of print or were hard to find, I would always check the grocery stores to see if they were selling used copies, because a lot of times you could find stuff there. Like people would, I guess, rent stuff there, but people wouldn't think, oh, I need to buy a video game. I should go buy a used one from the grocery store, because it's kind of counterintuitive. But I didn't rent from those places a lot, but I did kind of keep an eye on them because, you know, like, hey, I need my Castlevania fix. Where's Castlevania?
And these were in the days in which the used game market wasn't this corporate behemoth run exploitative operation. It was just like, oh, we're done with this game. Do you want to buy it? Not like, give us your games for a nickel.
Yeah, Funko Land was still just in the back of magazines.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The definitely supermarkets were a big market back then. We even would pillage their employees sometimes because they were good stores a lot of times, which was the crazy part. You think about going to in Toledo, we had Kroger's and Churchill's and Foodtown, and they would have a decent selection for a small store. It's not like they just threw stuff up on the walls because everybody else had it. Yeah, it's such a big market. There were thousands of video stores by the mid 90s, just saturating everywhere. Yeah,
yeah. Even some Walmarts had video rental sections.
Yeah,
I think those have gone away. But
yeah, I would imagine.
But I mean, yeah, you'd go to like a super Walmart in the 90s, and there would be a big kind of like standalone video store, like rental store, up at the front, separate from the video section in the back of the store.
Yeah, totally. Talk about what killed them.
Yes, what killed them? Was it?
It was you.
We got out. We took them with us.
I know video killed the radio star, but what killed the video star?
So a lot of things. Like, by the time Netflix came around, video stores were already going downhill. Mm-hmm. The death of VHS really hurt video stores because, even though they became more common to see at retail prices, still most movies that weren't big were still expensive. And so when DVD came out, studios were like, screw it, we're putting this out. Everything's rental. I mean, everything is retail. And less people rented movies because a rental could be $5 you could buy the movie for $20. And at the time, people were really into special features. The kind of person who rented a lot would be the kind of person who wanted a commentary track and would want deleted scenes and stuff like that.
This is my experience, but I think that was part of the lie the DVDs were selling you. Like, you'll want to build a library. You'll watch these movies over and over again. They're only $20 each. Here, put them everywhere.
Yep.
And I regret buying so many DVDs because it seemed like such a good idea at the time. And I got rid of most of my DVDs.
Yeah, I never got in the habit. Once I had to pay for rentals, I never got in the habit of doing it. So I am that guy who owns thousands of or hundreds of movies. But like, DVD was a big factor. And then Netflix was, I think, the really also a huge factor in that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, DVD is something we didn't really talk about, but the changeover was really difficult for video stores because they had to repurchase their entire library.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they owned all these VHS tapes, and all of a sudden those became... I mean, people were still renting them, I know, but...
But yeah, another big thing was that Blockbuster bought all the video stores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They bought so many of them. And then when Blockbuster went under, all those other stores didn't come back, you know? So we did for a while, but that didn't last either.
Yeah, it's that weird thing about capitalism where it's just like devour, 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 become bigger. So everything consolidates and then all of a sudden it's too big and too unwieldy and it can't survive and then it all goes away.
Yeah.
It's very fun to revisit shows from the 90s and movies from the 90s in which there's many a joke made at the expense of Blockbuster being the biggest corporation ever, and there were Blockbuster Awards, whatever those were. What were those?
I don't know.
Did fans vote on those? Like, people's choice? No, okay. I think you voted at Blockbuster Video.
Yeah. The thing about Blockbuster was, in my experience, no one liked them.
Yeah.
Ever. It was just, it was like Walmart or Best Buy. It was like, it was your choice. So you went there and you had no other options, really, you know? It was a big bummer, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in the mid to late 90s, I did most of my video rentals from... a locally owned place. I was living in Abilene, Texas at the time. It was just this little place called Game Boys.
And it was, that's a great name.
It is. It was just locally run. It was like a dude and his wife, and they were probably, you know, like in their 30s. And they just had a little shop where you could rent video games, and they also sold some. And I tried to like give them all the business I could. I didn't rent a ton of games, but when I rented, I would go there, and they would sell used games. So I bought stuff like Persona there. And I would try to do special orders through them and, you know, like say, hey, I want to buy this game that's coming up. Can I pre-order through you? And that turned out not to be very good because they were a smaller store. So they weren't getting stuff, you know, day and date of release. It was kind of like when it comes in. So I tried that. It was like, oh, but I really want to play this game now. So it was tough, but I did my best. But eventually I think they like... switched over to DVD rentals more or less and then folded.
I think the one of the major benefits of the smaller stores we didn't talk about is that you would get employees with expertise because it was a different world in which, oh, I'll just work this retail job and make a living. Oh, I like movies. I'll work at a video store.
Yeah.
And you'd get people who knew what they were doing and knew what they were talking about, could recommend you things. Those people don't last long at a big corporate-owned place because their passion is like ends up being their enemy. Like, no, don't recommend things you like. Recommend the things you have to sell.
Yeah.
And they are just – they're like, well, I don't care about this anymore. I can sell anything. I don't want to sell out my principles because I like movies.
Yeah, we had that at our store, you know. And it was – looking back, it's kind of funny as the 14-year-old kid working there recommending R-rated thrillers and horror movies to, you know, adults was weird. But yeah.
But you were tall enough to pull it off.
Yeah, I mean,
oh, he's got to be at least 20.
Yeah.
Just a very fresh face 20.
But I remember having a good relationship as a teenager with people at one of my local stores, just like, I like this classic movie. What should I watch? And they tell me, and I'd end up usually liking it. So.
Yeah, and I think that is what is one thing that did help video stores stay a little bit longer. And it's, I think, one thing people don't realize is gone about a video store. Like, the one thing you can't get on Netflix. There's a lot of big differences with games and movies, like the renting experience. Like, you would go to a video store and you wouldn't know what you'd want. And you'd browse. And that's how you'd find something. And you can do that on Netflix, but it's really not the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're scrolling linearly as opposed to taking in a whole wall of videos.
Yeah.
And like, oh, something just caught my eye. What is that?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I like streaming, but I feel like even with Netflix DVDs, once you receive something in the mail, you feel like, oh, I have an obligation to experience this. Otherwise, I'm wasting money. But with 400 movies to stream and 9 million animes to stream, it's just like, well, nothing will happen if I don't watch these.
Yeah.
And I will never see that money unless I'm looking at my bank account and scrutinizing it. So who cares?
Yeah, I remember when I moved to Pittsburgh in 2004, there were still quite a few video stores in my neighborhood. We had four in like two streets, and Netflix was coming around at the same time. And I didn't get Netflix because I wanted recommendations. I wanted people to help me. I wanted to browse. Four became three. Three became two.
Mm-hmm.
There was one left. I was the only customer. You know, I think, you know, that kind of viewpoint became a minority very quick. For me, it bums me out because that's not the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an experience that's gone away in all forms of media, except, yeah, I guess, bookstores.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of indie bookstores around, and they still, yes, you know, you go and the staff knows what they're talking about, and they'll put out those little cards that are like, the staff recommends, and it's like hand-drawn and written, you know.
Yeah.
It gives a, you know, like a little paragraph of explanation, but otherwise it's pretty much gone. Like, I don't know. I recently subscribed to Marvel Unlimited because, mm-hmm, I feel like I should read old comics and new comics and see what's up. Mm-hmm. And it's just not the same as like browsing through this, you know, an alphabetical list of comics, as opposed to going to a comic book store and there's just a rack of stuff and asking like the 50-year-old dude behind the counter who's been working there since he was a teenager, like, what's good? What should I read? And getting a recommendation that may or may not be weird, but it's, you know, at least it's, you know, coming from a place of the heart.
Yeah.
Used bookstores still exist, especially where I come from in the Bay Area. There's like five good ones in Berkeley, but there are no independent video stores in Berkeley that I know of. In fact, our friend Henry worked at the last one in Berkeley that closed like 3 or 4 years ago. And there is one, I mean, SF used to be much more bohemian. Now it's just like a tech dungeon that's being ravaged by horrible billionaires. But
well, you still got like the Outer Sunset or like the Richmond or something.
It's all changing slowly. It's being corrupted. But there's like maybe one notable video store, and that's Lost Weekend, that basically had to have like a fundraiser to stay open.
Yeah.
And I believe the new Alamo Draft House, I think it inherited – they are now also a video rental store because they inherited a store that closed down as well.
Yeah, there was still a place, you know, last I checked, out of the Sunset District that was just like a classic video store.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're still around, but they were like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, I it's hard to say, but Lost Weekend is the big one, like the most notable one. But they, even in a town like San Francisco, they needed a fundraiser to stay open.
Right, but then, you know, if you want bookstores, you've got like Green Apple and City, yeah, Lights, and there's just tons and tons of them.
Yeah.
So I don't know why books have remained viable, because you can also get those. Like, those are the easiest thing to get in digital form.
That's true.
Kindle, like, that was the first thing to come out, like your own personal video, like book reader. But
I do read a lot, and I also read a lot of digital books, but I will say a Kindle version of a paperback will be like $8, but I can go to the bookstore and be like, oh, it's $3, and I can either, right, throw it away when I'm done or just give it back to them or give it to a library. So, yeah.
And a lot of – you talked about getting, you know, Alamo Drafthouse buying it or stuff like that. A lot of the video stores that are left have kind of had to change. Some became screening rooms. Some are nonprofits. They've taken donations, stuff to stay afloat. They really tailor their selection towards older things, because if you want a new movie, you can get on Amazon Prime or Netflix. You don't need to go out, you know? So they've really had, and that's, I think, a good idea, because like if you're on Netflix and you want to watch, there are no old movies on Netflix now.
It sucks. Yeah.
Yeah. My boyfriend and I watched, in Japan, it's even worse. In Netflix Japan, with old movies from any country. But, like, we watched Richard Pryor's Stir Crazy because we could. It was on Netflix. I'm like, a movie from the 80s on Netflix? Wow.
Well, yeah, on Netflix, you have to go, like, through 20 categories to find classics first.
Yeah.
It's just like, where are the classics?
Yeah. But, you know, those video stores that have tailored their selection, they don't talk about video games. Like, a lot of them don't rent video games anymore. So, like, why there is still a very small amount of video stores for people who want to rent movies, there are almost, I think, very few probably for video games now. And if you want to rent video games, what's your options? Gamefly?
Gamefly.
They still exist?
They do, yeah.
Okay, good
yeah.
for them.
They supported Retronauts last year.
Hey, all right.
I was a Gameflyer for like 6 years, and it's not like going to a video store, yeah. but it was also very cheap.
Yeah. So like, I think the renting video games definitely is died more than even movies. Like,
yeah.
It's like renting movies is like something that 5% of the population can do. Renting video games is like 1% for some reason. Mm. Yeah. It's a bummer. Except in Japan, video stores, just like Tower Records, video stores are still kicking it here.
Yeah, we just went to a four-story Tower Records, and I bought a $40 CD.
Yeah.
But there were two discs in there.
Yeah,
so.
But Tsutaya is the... Tsutaya, hard for me to say.
Yeah,
Tsutaya. Yeah. Tsutaya is the big chain here, and I hear people tell me they're not doing so good, but they're everywhere, and they're always busy. So
yeah, it's not like that Tower Records was empty. There are people.
Oh man, yeah,
all over that place.
I think it's the collector culture here for retail, for buying things. I think there's a collector culture here for video rental. I have no idea why it's still so popular here for new movies, because the internet is better here.
Hmm.
Netflix is newer here. It took a long time, and the big one here is Hulu. Hulu's the big streaming service. Hulu is the it's like. Japan doesn't use eBay, they use Yahoo Auctions. Japan doesn't use Netflix as much, they use Hulu.
They don't have Twitter, they have Line.
Yeah, that came first. So, I don't know who is renting stuff in Japan. But they're doing it, so good on them.
Let's wrap up by, I'm curious, like, what's your maybe favorite rental experience? Were there any games, great games you discovered through rental, like things that changed your life?
Well, I think the benefit of me as a renter was I don't think anyone had the same taste as me or was reading every video game magazine. So it was just like, oh, this really huge RPG is coming out. I wonder if they'll have a copy. Oh, they do. And no one would ever rent it. So I played through Chrono Trigger through rental instead of paying $80 for it, because I was reading all the reviews like, oh my God, they better have a copy. And they always did. And I could re-rent it whenever I wanted to, because no one cared. So, I grew up with a bunch of tasteless cowards who did not like JRPGs. So man, yeah, I just had a lot of good experiences in that way.
As someone who didn't have to pay late fees, I would imagine the video store, the Sights and Sounds, that's our company, our video store, closest to my house, was a bad place to rent video games, because if you wanted to rent Final Fantasy III or Chrono Trigger or anything that took a long time, I usually had it. I was a spoiled little kid, I guess. But I remember on the customer profile on the computer, there was like days late of a title. And my copy of Final Fantasy III, the store's copy, became my copy because the hours rolled over to zero. I had it so
they
long.
Grandfathered you in.
Pretty much, yeah. That when I was playing RPGs more, yeah.
Yeah, video rentals, I mean, they're pretty much the foundation of this podcast for me in a lot of ways. So many of the experiences that I've talked about, the games that I've talked about that I love, I discovered them through rentals. And, you know, whether it was Secret of Mana, which kind of pulled me back into video games at a time that I thought, well, I've outgrown these. I don't need to play video games anymore. Like, I played that entirely through rental. I finished it over a Christmas break. You know, I mentioned Battle of Olympus earlier. There were lots of games like that, that Strider or whatever, you know, that I would maybe see something similar to it in the arcades. Mm. But, I couldn't necessarily afford to own it, but I could definitely rent it. And so, yeah, that's where a lot of my video game memories come from.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I would say, like, from the NES era to the PlayStation 1 era, I probably experienced 75% of those libraries through rentals exclusively. And also, it would make me take a lot of chances. I don't normally like this type of game. This cover art is weird. I don't know what it is, but I'll take a chance for a weekend that I wouldn't take a chance spending $60 on or $50 on. So it did open up my mind to a lot of different kinds of games, some of them I like. So I feel like without that, I would have just very limited experience.
Yeah, I think one thing about video stores dying off and this whole thing that kind of makes me sad is that, like, from a nostalgia standpoint, like, video games were very video stores were a really important part, I think, for anyone of our generation playing video games. But we all have shared nostalgia for video games and other stuff from our childhood. Video stores were localized. They were local. And so it's like, unless you still are friends with who you were friends with in your hometown, that's, you know, your memories, you can't, there's no one to share it with. Like, when I was getting ready for this episode, I was looking on YouTube trying to find old video store commercials just to see what was out there. There's not a lot of old video store commercials on YouTube, and I was really surprised. There's a ton of Blockbuster.
Yeah, that's funny. You mentioned that whenever I go home, which is not that often, to my old hometown, I will drive by sadly and look at, like, that used to be the place I rented videos, and now it's a gym? What?
They sell cell phones? That's not good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of big stores just didn't have advertising because they didn't need to. So, like, you can't even get that little piece of a firmer again because it never even existed in the first place. Like, we never had advertising. We didn't need it. So, yeah.
I want to mention one thing before we go, which I think this podcast would be remiss without mentioning, is the movie Clerks, which was like a snapshot in time in which nothing could be more important to your average Joe than the rental store.
Oh, man.
And did Kevin Smith buy RST Video just to keep it open or something? I forget what happened there.
I don't know what happened to RST. I know Quickstop's still kicking it.
Yeah, but they were, like, next to each other.
Clerks, and I know Kevin Smith's kind of a joke.
People, and he was a video store clerk like Quentin Tarantino, right?
Yeah, he worked at both.
Okay.
You know, because they owned by the same company. And I know Kevin Smith's output is a little more uneven these days, and people, like, I hear people retconning his legacy, but that's complete bullshit. Clerks was one of the most important movies in filmmaking, and for anybody, it changed filmmaking like Pulp Fiction did. That style of filmmaking, low budget, stuff like that. But also, if you worked in a video store, that was a documentary.
Yeah.
I have lost count of the people who have asked me a variation of, do you have that one movie with that guy?
Right.
My favorite was, I'm looking for a horror movie about zombies that has an R in the title. I was like, is it Reanimator? No?
Return
of the Living Dead? Yeah. No? You're on your own, man. I can't help you.
Man.
But, like, yeah. When Clerks came out, I was 14, 15. I watched it with my parents. It was awkward.
Great.
I learned bad words. But, like, it was like the Bible for us. Like, it was like never seeing anything like that, and it completely understood the culture, the attitudes, the kind of humor plus nihilism of working in retail, you know. But, yeah.
Yeah, no movie had the perspective.
No movie had perspective, yeah. And I rewatched it with my boyfriend last year, and it's still a damn good movie.
But I will say, Quentin Tarantino must have been the most annoying video store clerk in the universe.
Yeah, we had people like him.
Yeah. It's like, oh man, you're just so intense, I just want to relax tonight.
Yeah, we were more like the Kevin Smith variety of, like, we weren't Randall, but we were just like, you go, yeah, that's a good movie, so get that. Okay, I'm going to go take a nap.
There was also the website Acts of Gord. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that.
I very heavily embellished and sort of self-puffed website about a guy who worked in a video game shop.
That's right.
It was basically like you know, a guy talking about how awesome he was for being rude to his customers. But some of the things in there you read and you were like, yes, I have seen those people. Like, I think there was a lot of, like, wish fulfillment. Like, I wish I could have told these people off.
Some of those were just like, well, that never happened.
Yeah.
Like, this is the conversation you had in your head after they left.
But it was still like, like,
am I conflating this with our former Retronaut Scott Sharkey and his own stories? Did he have a website with those too? Or
he didn't. Okay. He just worked in a video store.
But yeah.
He was, I'm willing to believe pretty much everything Sharkey says. So, like, over it, and I think he's been over it since he was a baby.
That's true.
That, like, he doesn't need to embellish. He's just like, yeah, here's some dumb shit I saw. It was so stupid.
I believe those stories.
It's, you know, we didn't have a ton of, like, incredibly disturbing stories. Customers from hell. I remember there was one person who didn't want a late fee, and they threw a VHS tape at someone's head.
Oh.
Which... that could mess you up.
That's assault.
That's assault, yeah. But other than that, and, like, you know, stories about break-ins, you know, you'd be amazed how, especially in the 80s, the lengths people would go to steal videos. Somebody one time just jumped through our front window. We had to put bars on the window. Yeah.
Wow.
But like our customers, I can't remember any particularly horrific ones that I want to share in a public forum. Yeah.
All right. So to wrap, this has been Retronauts talking about video stores, somewhat video game related.
Yeah.
Part of the overall culture that I think, you know, video games were a part of. Sometimes you get into media and it's just hard to divide things out. So, James, you want to tell us where we can find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Lost Turntable and also my blog, lostturntable.com.
Hi, it's Bob. Hi, it's me. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also do other podcasts outside of this one. You might have heard of them. That's Talking Simpsons, our chronological exploration of The Simpsons, and also the podcast What a Cartoon. That's a different episode of a different cartoon every week. We go into it, the history. It's sort of like a let's play for a cartoon, if that makes sense. And we also have a Patreon. Go to patreon.com/talking simpsons. There's tons and tons of bonus content there you can get if you sign up, like series like Talking Critic and Talking Futurama, which Jeremy and Jerry has been on two episodes of. Jerry's your evil twin, by the way.
Is he?
I forgot to tell you about that.
Dang it.
And lots of things like interviews with Simpsons writers and directors like the great David Silverman and showrunners, and just so much stuff is going on there. Both Retronauts and that are sort of my full-time job, so just give to everybody that's involved in this, I say. You're generous. You're a nice person, I swear.
Sure. And finally, I'm Jeremy Parrish, suffering from, I think, allergies to Japan's love of cigarette smoke. I can't deal with that stuff anymore. So I apologize for sounding all stuffed up. But hey, it's been a fun conversation anyway. You can find me on the internet at Retronauts.com, on Twitter as GameSpite. And Retronauts itself, of course, is also at Retronauts.com and on the iTunes store or iTunes, whatever the hell it is, the internet. You'll find us. We're out there. And, of course, we're supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. Your support keeps us going, and in return, we give you other stuff. So check it out. It's cool. We're great. We love you. You love us. Let's hug it out. Thanks, everyone.